Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. 50 currencies, 170 countries. One account designed to take on the world. So whether you're taking on Rio or Rome, Miami or Mumbai, you'll always get the mid-market exchange rate when you convert currencies, with no markups and no hidden fees. Wise helps you save money no matter where you're going next. Join 15 million people and businesses who are going global with Wise. Learn how the Wise account could work for you by downloading the app or visiting wise.com/world.
In Turkey, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan gets 5 more years. Election observers say it was a free vote, but not a fair one.
The ballot boxes are already stuffed.
They say it's become almost impossible for opposition parties to reach voters with an alternative. Also ahead, drones strike civilian targets in Moscow. Kyiv says it wasn't them, but...
These are the types of drones, at least some of them, that are operated exclusively by the Ukrainian military.
I'm Carol Hills. Also ahead, a new president in Nigeria. The election remains disputed. Still, many say the peaceful transition points to a maturing of democracy.
Instead of people going on the streets, they are using the machinery.
The machinery of the judiciary. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Here's something we haven't heard before. Video footage that appears to be drones exploding over the suburbs of Moscow. Moscow is blaming Ukraine for the attacks that it says damaged 3 residential buildings. President Vladimir Putin told Russian media they are provoking us into taking mirror actions. Ukraine is denying responsibility. Cybersecurity expert Dmitry Alperovich has been monitoring the strikes closely. He runs the think tank, the Silverado Policy Accelerator. Alperovich says the drones targeting Moscow struck in upper middle class areas of the capital.
One in particular appears to have landed near a place called Rublevka, which is a very famous place where Russian elites, both business elites and government elites, have their villas. Putin's residence is not too far, maybe 10 minutes away from there.
Do we know what damage they caused in these places?
So far, not really. We know that a few of them have been intercepted and shot down. Some of them apparently either hit the apartment buildings and caused minor damage or potentially fell on it as they were being targeted by the Russians.
So it's interesting. You mentioned that at least one targeted a wealthy neighborhood where Putin has a house and other elite Russians. That seems like a pretty bold move. What do we know about the drones themselves? What sort were they?
Well, at least some of them appear to be Ukrainian-made drones that we have seen before used in a number of strikes by the Ukrainians on Russian territory. This is by far the most advanced and most coordinated strike on Moscow itself, although there have been prior strikes on Moscow, including the famous one just a few weeks ago on the Kremlin itself. But the numbers here are quite significant. And we know that the range of these drones is about 800 kilometers, so they could have easily gone all the way from northern Chernihiv Oblast that is under control of Ukraine all the way to Moscow.
Do we know actually where they were launched from?
We do not. Chernihiv probably the most likely area because it's the shortest path to Moscow from Ukrainian-held territory.
So what's the proof that these drones were launched by Ukraine's military?
Well, we don't have any proof, but we do know that the Ukrainians have been targeting Russian territory. We know that the U.S. government believes that some of the prior strikes, particularly the strike on the Kremlin, was the work of Ukrainian forces, potentially affiliated with the Ukrainian government. And these are the types of drones, at least some of them, that are operated exclusively by the Ukrainian military.
Now, Russia has threatened most severe measures in response. But in early May, when 2 drones exploded over the Kremlin, Russia blamed Kyiv. But we didn't see much of a response from Moscow. What do you expect this time around?
If they had options for escalation, we would have already seen them by now. And obviously, they don't want to use the nuclear card. They've been warned off of it by the Chinese. But aside from that, they don't have huge stockpiles of missiles to send. They don't have thousands of Iranian drones, so they're quite limited in what they can do.
Now, more than 500 miles to the west, Kyiv, of course, has been the target of Russian drone attacks 3 times over the past day or so. What stands out for you about those attacks?
Well, what stands out to me is how effective Ukraine air defenses have been. There have been a lot of speculation that Ukraine may be running out of old Soviet-era missile interceptors for those air defenses. But of course, they've been provided with Patriot systems and IRIS-T systems from Europe, and they've been remarkably effective.
Are there noticeable differences between the types of drones Russia is using compared to Ukraine?
Well, Russia is using the Shahed 136 drones and some others as well from Iran that have been custom built for this type of kamikaze missions. What the Ukrainians are using are really homemade, almost homemade drones that are quite noisy. For now, at least, they're fairly primitive. But the fact that they're able to get to Moscow is significant.
Huh. A Ukrainian presidential aide, Mykhailo Podolyak, denied Kyiv was directly involved in today's attacks. But he did say, "We are pleased to watch." An attack like this, targeting a civilian area, that's a war crime. Wouldn't Kyiv be ceding a moral high ground if it was involved in this attack?
Well, we don't know what the ultimate target of these drones was. They could have been targeting military systems, installations. They could have been targeting government installations as well. I don't think it's likely that the Ukrainians would have programmed these drones to strike apartment buildings. It's likely that they were just shot down or were disabled over those areas.
Do you think that there's little control over where the drones land, so this is accidental?
Well, the Ukrainians have control in terms of being able to reprogram them, but if the Russians are using sophisticated GPS jamming technologies, the Ukrainian drones would lose coordination and would potentially land where they were being jammed.
Yeah, I mean, are you yourself concerned that if these drone attacks on Moscow hit civilians or kill civilians, that that could affect support for Ukraine?
I think it's certainly an option, and I think that's why you're seeing Ukrainians not really wanting to come out and admit that they're behind this. We've seen them target civilians in the past by recruiting them to execute operations against strategic targets. So, for example, the Kerch Bridge, the critical link between Crimea and the rest of Russia that was blown up last October, is widely believed to have been an innocent driver that was recruited by the Ukrainians unwittingly, and a bomb detonated in that truck. But direct targeting of civilians certainly, I think, would be widely condemned.
Cybersecurity expert Dmitry Alperovich runs the think tank, the Silverado Policy Accelerator. He joined us from Washington. Thanks, Dmitry.
Thank you.
This weekend in Turkey, voters handed President Recep Tayyip Erdogan another 5 years in office. Erdogan captured 52% of the vote in a runoff. International observers are calling the vote free but not fair. They say Erdogan's centralized control over the Turkish government gave him an unfair campaign advantage. The World's Duri Buscarin went inside a Turkish polling station in Istanbul and filed this report.
Ballot box 1037 sits in a primary school classroom in central Istanbul. For the entire day, neighbors have come in to mark their ballot, fold it into an envelope, and slip it into a clear plastic bin at the front of the room. At 5 p.m., many voters come back and sit at the desks. This is how Turkey counts its votes. After a procedure to check the number of ballots, poll worker Yilmaz Yilmaz takes each one and announces who it's for. He holds the ballot over his head to show the room.
Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu.
As he announces the votes, everyone in the room tracks the count on their own sheet of paper. Anyone can object if the vote is unclear or announced incorrectly.
Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu.
The room is tense. This neighborhood is mostly voting for opposition candidate Kılıçdaroğlu. After claims of voting irregularities in the first round of elections, it feels like the presidency isn't the only thing at stake here. This is about whether Turkey's elections reflect the will of the people. After an hour or so, four young Erdogan supporters appear at the doorway. When poll worker Yılmaz lifts a vote for Erdogan over his head, they repeat his name loudly. Please, this is a vote for Erdogan. There's no need for anything else, a poll worker says. The rest of the votes were counted without incident at ballot box 1037. But later, those same four men got into a scuffle in the hallway and had to be taken outside. I switched to recording on my cell phone, just in case they notice a foreign journalist and get upset. Once outside, in the schoolyard, they start a chant meant to intimidate opposition voters. Disruptions like these are fairly rare in Turkey. Voter turnout for the runoff was high at 86%.
Democracy umudu.
They have faith in democracy, says Neslihan, a Kılıçdaroğlu voter who asked not to be named due to the risks of criticizing the Turkish government. She says she fears for the future, another 5 years of unorthodox economic policies and the silencing of dissent.
Ben karanlık görüyorum. Keşke hatalı olsam, karanlık görüyorum. Herkes buradan kaçmak isteyecek.
I see that it will be dark, she says. I hope I'm wrong. Everyone will want to leave the country. Regardless of the outcome, experts say counting by hand in the presence of witnesses keeps Turkish election results fairly reliable. Gonol Tol is an expert with the Middle East Institute and the author of Erdogan's War.
It boosts people's faith in the process because it's not that easy to rig the elections.
But it's what happens before the votes are counted that's problematic, Tol says. The ruling party has the advantage of a loyal judiciary, election board, and media corps during the campaign.
If it creates an environment where it's almost impossible for the opposition parties to communicate with the voters, to present them with an alternative, then the ballot boxes are already stuffed.
But by winning in a two-round election, Tol says, Erdogan gets a stamp of legitimacy for the next 5 years. For many Erdogan voters, the day after the election brought a feeling of relief.
I feel safety and better than yesterday.
A medical student named Nasibe said she voted for Erdogan because he represents her identity as a Sunni Muslim. She asked not to share her last name because her friends voted differently.
Herkesin kendi ideolojilerini koruması gerekiyor. Benim için en uygun.
Everyone should protect their own ideology, Nasibe says in Turkish. I didn't know what would happen if Kılıçdaroğlu won, so I did what was safe for me. Her friend Tuba, a nursing student, agrees. She had feared that a Kılıçdaroğlu government would walk back rights for religious people.
I know there are some problems with our politics, with economy, maybe rights about people. We know there are problems, but we feel safe that people are working on these issues.
By the time Erdogan completes this new presidential term, he will have led Turkey for a quarter of a century. For the world, I'm Derya Buskarin in Istanbul.
Our next story comes from the waters around Portugal and Spain.
There have now been a series of orca attacks on boats in
Wednesday, a group of orcas slammed into a sailing boat, damaging the rudder and tearing a hole in the bottom.
Last Wednesday, the crew of a 65-foot yacht sailing off Gibraltar had to be rescued after orcas damaged their boat. An attack by killer whales sounds rather scary.
I understand how it's being characterized as attacks, but I think it's being sensationalized a little bit.
Monica Whelan-Shields directs the Orca Behavior Institute based on San Juan Island in Washington State. She says there is no cause for alarm.
It's extremely local behavior to this specific population in this specific waterway.
This recording, posted to a Facebook page called Orca Attack Reports, shows one craft near the Strait of Gibraltar. A group of orcas surround the boat and repeatedly ram into its hull. A frightening moment for the people on board. But Shields says that during hundreds of such incidents around the Iberian Peninsula, there's been a little bit of damage, but not one person has been hurt.
You know, it seems like a play behavior or some type of game to them that they've discovered and they're telling their friends about it. And it's something that is the current fad among this population right now.
Young male orcas just acting out.
It's concerning for the damage that they're causing for sure. But I think if it were aggression, that they could cause a lot more damage than what we've seen.
While some observers, especially boat owners, are raising concern, Shields, who studies orca behavior, is taking a wait-and-see approach.
I wouldn't be at all surprised if they drop it as quickly as they picked it up.
Something for sailors around Gibraltar to look forward to. Nigeria moves forward after a contested presidential election. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Hope is back for Nigeria. That's the message from Bola Tinubu. He was sworn in as Nigeria's new president on Monday in the capital, Abuja. Tinubu was announced the winner of a contentious election back in February. He's promising to work on behalf of all Nigerians, but the country is facing some huge challenges. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi is on the line from Nairobi. Halima, you covered Nigeria's elections. What's the feeling in Nigeria right now following Tinubu's swearing in? I mean, are Nigerians feeling hopeful?
Well, I think people are feeling quite mixed. On one hand, there's a lot of excitement because this is Nigeria's seventh democratic transfer of power, which is a big deal, especially considering the coups that have happened recently in West Africa. So there's a lot of pride for that fact. At the same time, there is also a lot of disappointment because there are a number of Nigerians who feel like their vote was stolen. They feel like Tinubu was not the real winner of this election. And right now, there's actually a court case where petitioners are disputing the results of the election and challenging his victory.
What's behind these legal challenges? What happened on election day that people are concerned about?
So those challenges have been filed by the main opposition leaders who lost a presidential election, and they've been calling for the results to be overturned. They say that there were a number of irregularities with the election that made it not free and fair, and the results of that case are expected in the coming weeks. I spoke with Idayat Hassan, who is with the Center for Democracy and Development in Abuja, and I asked her what she thought about the case.
We are very happy that people have gone to court because it also represents a maturing of democracy. Instead of people going on the streets, they are using the machinery of the judiciary.
She added that there were pros and cons in the recent election. In the end, it was competitive, but it was also flawed, which observers had said too. But ultimately, she said it will be up to the courts to evaluate the evidence and decide. And the president, Tinubu, also said in his inaugural speech yesterday that it is the right of his opponents to go to court.
What message is Bola Tinubu sending to Nigerians now as he begins his term in office?
Well, he made a lot of promises that really speak to the most pressing issues in Nigeria right now. Let's start with the economy. When I was in Nigeria, people couldn't even access cash from their banks. They struggle to get fuel. There's also really high unemployment in a young country. So the president promised, for example, to bring 1 million jobs in the digital economy. He also promised to address the poor infrastructure, deal with corruption. But most importantly, he talked about insecurity. Right now, Nigeria is still plagued by terrorism. Crime is rising. And he said that he would prioritize that.
Security shall be top priority of our administration, because neither prosperity nor justice can prevail amid insecurity and violence.
And he promised to reform the security sector. But the big question is, will he live up to all of these promises? I mean, the outgoing president, Muhammadu Buhari, who was present at the inauguration yesterday, he also made a lot of promises when he stepped into office. But years later, there was a lot of disappointment among Nigerians. Many of them, including people from his own party and from his own region, feel like he let them down. So the big question is, will Tinubu live up to these promises? And there's a lot at stake, not only for Nigeria, but also for the region, because security in Nigeria is essential for security in the region.
Halima Gikandi is the World's Africa correspondent, and she's been speaking with us from Nairobi, Kenya. Thanks so much, Halima.
Thank you so much.
For prospective home buyers in England, there's a familiar problem. Homes are too expensive and there's not enough of them. But the opposition Labour Party has a proposal: make landowners sell off some of what they own to develop new housing. To fill us in, we turn to Anthony Breach in London with the charity and think tank, the Centre for Cities. Anthony, start by painting us a picture here. Just how hard is it for the average person in England to buy a home?
So it's really quite expensive. It's probably one of the most unaffordable housing markets in the developed world. So we're finding that the average house costs about 9 or 10 times the average income. So it's really very unaffordable. And that's particularly concentrated in the places with greatest economic opportunity. So places like London, Oxford, Cambridge, which have the highest wages and the best chances of career progression, you're seeing ratios where houses are 12, 13, 14, 15 times the average income. So it's really a very severe housing crisis in England at the moment.
So the opposition Labour Party, they have a proposal to address this. What exactly is it?
It's a change to compulsory purchase orders, which are essentially like eminent domain in the United States. Now, historically, after the Second World War, this kind of eminent domain process was really important for local governments, local councils, to buy cheap rural land and then build cheap public housing on that land. Now, that changed over the past few decades following the Second World War, but now the land values that have to be paid in the current eminent domain process are very high. So the proposal that Labour has come up with and is talking about today would sort of wind the clock back a little bit and force landowners to accept lower values for land and receive less compensation and give councils more power to do that.
So currently, in order for the government to use eminent domain, they have to basically pay market rates for land?
Correct, yes. And it's a very complicated and long and drawn out process.
So if this went through, if the Labour Party proposed a law, say for the sake of argument, that Parliament passes it, what difference do you think this could make?
So I think it would probably make it easier to build new council housing, certainly in perhaps some patches of land around London.
And council housing, that's what we would call public housing?
Exactly right. So there's this kind of long tradition in the UK of local governments buying land in this way and providing subsidised public housing for residents in that manner. Kind of two problems, I think, with what Labour's proposing. One is that in poorer parts of the country where there's less housing demand, there's going to be less need to build houses in the first place. And so this tool isn't going to make a big difference in those places. But also in the kind of deep kind of rural hinterlands around the big cities, where there's very acute housing need, but the planning system that we have in England makes it very, very difficult to build houses. But local councils there aren't going to be wanting to use this power in the first place. So there's actually only a very small number of places and councils in England that have this kind of combination of wanting to use this power and then also having rural lands on which they can use this power.
So if Labour's proposal, if that doesn't fix the problem, what other options are there to ease the housing crisis?
So you might be aware in the United States, there are these new debates around the role of zoning in making housing unaffordable. You know, zoning barriers make it difficult to build. You often get this single family zoning where you can only build quite large, quite expensive single family houses for development of the United States. In the UK, we have something considerably more restrictive than zoning. We have what's called a discretionary planning system in which every single permit is decided case by case. So currently in the UK, even if you follow the rules, you can still be denied a permit by the local government if they can just decide not to grant that. So it can be very, very difficult, and it often is very, very difficult to build new houses in large parts of England. And moving from that case-by-case, unpredictable system to a more certain and a more rules-based process, that's the big change which we need in England to make housing more affordable.
And is there any movement or support for changing those rules to make it less arbitrary?
Yes, actually. I think there's now much bigger awareness that the planning system in the UK was so unpredictable, so case by case, is a big problem. And that fixing it is not just a part of how we deliver cheaper housing in the UK, but it's also crucial to fixing the kind of deepening economic crisis the UK is in, where we've not had very significant amounts of economic growth for the past 13 years. Building more housing, building more commercial buildings, that's increasingly coming to be seen as part of the recipe that the UK needs to experience higher living standards 5, 10, 15 years from now.
We've been speaking to Anthony Breech. He's a senior analyst at the Centre for Cities, a think tank and a registered charity based in the UK. Thanks a lot, Anthony.
Great. Thanks, Carol.
You're listening to The World. In mainland China, the Tiananmen Square massacre is simply not discussed. In Hong Kong, the upcoming anniversary has long been observed.
But certainly with this purge of library books, they are very much seeking to either rewrite history or suppress it in Hong Kong, just as they do in the mainland.
Rewriting history in Hong Kong, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In Uganda, the harsh clampdown on LGBTQ people just got harsher. Under a new law, people engaged in same-sex relationships could face life in prison or even be put to death. President Biden is calling it shameful. For more on what the new law means and the international response, we called Maria Burnett. She's a senior associate in the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I asked her what the new law means for Uganda's relationship with countries around the world.
This happened before, so I think this is the troubling reality, is that a similar bill was tabled previously. So this is a bit of a Groundhog Day moment, obviously, for governments who are committed to non-discrimination. This is a game changer. I think this is early days. The bill was only signed yesterday. We've seen a lot of condemnatory statements. Unfortunately, you know, because President Museveni has been in power for over three decades now and has had a deteriorating human rights situation, we've seen a lot of condemnatory statements over the years from the US, from the EU, and other key stakeholders. So I don't think that what's come out thus far is, you know, really hitting Uganda where it may hurt. But I think hopefully we will see some real action in the coming days. Action from the World Bank to, you know, indicate that this law violates their own ability to do some lending with Uganda. We may see some visa sanctions and other sanctions coming out of the US or the EU. So I think there's a lot more action to come in concrete terms. And ideally, all those actions will compel the court to, you know, hear this case, the constitutional challenge, which activists are filing as we speak.
Yeah, I think we're all wondering whether this law, which has now been signed into law by President Museveni, is it enough to make Uganda a kind of international pariah? Or is the opposition across the world just not necessarily strong enough to make that happen?
This is a battleground issue. We're seeing this in the United States as well. But the Biden administration and certainly the leadership in the European Union and many other countries that are really key donors to the government of Uganda for a wide range of, you know, key sectors, from health to education to humanitarian support, law enforcement, all of those sectors in Uganda are very reliant on those key donors. And therefore, I think this will be a test moment to see what actions those stakeholders take in the face of this abhorrent legislation. This is about much more than criminalizing same-sex conduct, although it does do that. This also criminalizes what they call promotion of homosexuality, which really seeks to ban all legitimate human rights and public health work, you know, key work around the fight against HIV/AIDS, and any work that would advocate for the rights of the LGBTIQ population.
President Museveni has been very defensive and couched the whole discussion of this in a way that says, this is Uganda's issue. They'll take action aligned with their values. And if the policy is wrong, they'll learn that on their own. In light of that, does the U.S. have any leverage to push Uganda to repeal this law or anything like that?
Well, obviously, President Museveni's words are ironic, given that the law that has been on the books in Uganda, the law that has criminalized same-sex conduct in Uganda for many, many, many years now, is a British colonial-era importation. We're seeing homophobia becoming, you know, a real practical import from the West, from Russia. I think it's absolutely critical for the West to use the leverage it has. Because of the criminalization of promotion issue in this law, there's just a practical reality here. You know, the U.S. government cannot seek to do and fund proper public health work if its own staff and employees and subcontractors are going to face potential incarceration for doing their jobs.
Now, the parliament in Uganda and President Museveni have not delivered solutions to many of Uganda's biggest problems. Bad roads, children die of malnutrition, massive theft of public funds, and more. To some extent, is this bill kind of an easy populist dunk for Museveni?
I think it is, unfortunately. I think it's important to remember that access to information and independent information in Uganda remains very difficult. It is very difficult to be an independent-minded journalist in Uganda. There is a governance crisis in Uganda that's been percolating for a long time. You know, every political rival of the president has ended up imprisoned. But I think the real challenge is that Uganda is really in a human rights crisis. That is, politically, there have been killings, extrajudicial killings, torture against political opponents. Elections have been not free and not fair. And so it's unfortunately unsurprising that in a context like this, this would be the next thing to come. It's a way to kind of drive some lame popularity by politicians who themselves are deeply corrupt.
Maria Burnett is a senior associate in the Africa program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Maria, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
If you're a young Russian opposed to your country's invasion of Ukraine, it can be a tough go right now. Face arrest for speaking out or possibly get drafted to fight in a war you don't support. A host of young Russian video game developers have fled their homes to avoid this and are now carving out new lives for themselves in Serbia. About a dozen have wound up in the quiet city of Subotica on the Hungarian border. Reporter Jerry Haddon caught up with them as part of our ongoing look at Russians and Ukrainians starting over in new countries.
When you're starting over, old rituals become new again. For Daniel Kuznetsov, a 24-year-old online game developer, That includes the simplest of things, like exercising.
Morning.
Hello.
How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm just from the gym and I'm very tired, but it feels okay. It's good to try some exercises, you know, for a long time.
I've met up with Kuznetsov on an early morning here in Subotica. He's winded after his first workout since fleeing Russia 8 months ago, but he invites me up to his tiny apartment where he now lives and works.
Home sweet home.
Yes.
Kuznetsov designs online video games. This one's simple, but kind of addictive. You search for stuff, like a digital version of Where's Wally?
I'll show you the game called Trip to Europe 4.
And what's the goal of the game?
The goal of the game is to, you know, visit some famous places in Europe, you know, find some items. It's like an imitation of the vacation, actually.
Kuznetsov says life was good in his home city of Voronezh in central Russia. He worked for an American game publisher, had his family and friends. When the war started, he was against it, he says, but he hung tight, hoping things would calm down. Then he lost his job.
When the war started, a lot of publishers just cut off their Russian employees. They said, we cannot work with you. We don't know how to send you the money. We don't know if we can actually send you the money because maybe we got sanctions from our government.
Kuznetsov was suddenly without income, and the war was escalating. Kuznetsov's mom had fled Russia for Serbia weeks earlier, so he packed a suitcase and headed for the airport.
And I was just praying to heaven. I was just going through the passport control. You know, I was sweating. I was nervous. What was I going to say? I say, okay, I'm going on vacation. Not mention anything about war or army. Use your, all your actors' abilities.
Kuznetsov made it out, and just in time. 2 weeks later, President Vladimir Putin ordered young men his age drafted or mobilized.
Mobilization was happening in Russia to many people, but it's actually happened to me, but in other way. I need to grab my things, I need to think about my future, I need to move on very fast.
To escape and to make a new life. Kuznetsov seems to be pulling it off. He's found a new job and changed his image. He shows me a closet full of stylish sports coats he's picked up from thrift stores. Every couple of weeks, he dyes his hair a different color. Today, it's pink. But the biggest change? He's socializing like crazy, he says, even with strangers.
In Russia, if somebody was talking to you in bar, he's probably a scam. He's probably a criminal and you should just leave this bar.
Bar hopping is how he met around a dozen other Russian game designers here in Subotica, among them Boris from St. Petersburg. Boris isn't his real name. He asked me to change it because he fears reprisals against his wife's family back home.
Because Russia now it's a fascist regime.
A fascist regime. Saying that back home would have landed Boris in hot water. So would offering free game design classes to anyone donating money to the Ukraine army. But that's what Boris did. He says he raised some 40,000 euros before things began to feel too dangerous.
We organized people who took the money to Ukraine. And if our government knew about this, they can take us to prison for whole our lives.
Rather than sitting in prison, Boris now works for an American gaming company. That pays the rent, he says, but what makes him feel most at home is skateboarding. It's become Boris's way of connecting with his Serbian neighbors. Skating is apolitical, he says, and to ride, you need your eyes facing forward. For Daniil Kuznetsov, that's the key as well. Though it's not always easy, even with new clothes, new hair, new just about everything. Kuznetsov has an 18-year-old brother, Artem. He was here, but went home. Kuznetsov says Artem felt lost in this new world. But since returning to Russia, he says, he's only gotten worse.
He's actually very depressed. He has suicide thoughts. He said, probably the world will end, in a year.
On this morning, Kuznetsov reaches Artem by phone, asks how he is. I'm actually feeling better, Artem says. I've realized I have to get up and do something, make something of my life. Kuznetsov offers to take him in here in Serbia, but Artem declines. Better the devil you know, he says, before hanging up. Back at the bar, Kuznetsov says he understands his brother, even if he's worried sick Artem might be drafted. At least, he says, his brother avoid what Kuznetsov calls the Russian expat dilemma.
Actually, when you live, you are hated in Russia and you're hated outside Russia. That's the problem. You cannot go to anywhere and think, okay, I am okay here.
Except he hopes maybe here in Serbia. a traditional Slav ally and admirer of all things Russian.
Oh, I love the country because, you know, it's the strange feeling that Serbians love Russians more than Russians. I feel here more at home, like more than Russia.
At this point, it's possible he'll settle here for good. For The World, I'm Jerry Hatton, Subotica, Serbia.
The rule of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia was short but devastating. In 1975, the Pol Pot regime embarked on a campaign to wipe out Cambodia's educated and ruling classes. Millions died in the genocide. Flash forward to today in Long Beach, California. Last week, Cal State University held a special ceremony for the descendants of Cambodians who escaped the regime. The public media outlet LAist shared the stories of some of the graduates.
My name's Arya Tok, middle name Arya Sivarat Tok. I was born and raised in Bellflower, California, in the suburbs. And right now we are in Long Beach, California, at my mom's salon of 30 plus years at Fancy Cuts. My mom is currently putting hair in my face. She is helping me prepare for the Cambodian ceremony today. The Cambodian Student Society and Cal State Long Beach is hosting a cultural graduation for the Cambodian American graduates and Cambodian graduates, like international students, and I will be attending it today. It's important because you see how all the past leads up to the present, into me choosing an art degree, me going into a field that my family doesn't know about, and even just seeing my family see me grow up as time goes on. Some people I talk about in my daily life, they don't know about the Khmer Rouge, and it was a huge genocide in the history of the world.
My name is Danali Tok. I'm preparing my daughter's hair for her Cambodian graduation today. In our family, my family, both sides, my mom and my dad, I think about 80% of us got killed. My father, I really don't know what happened to him because during the Khmer Rouge, we wait for him to come back home, but we never get to see him come back home. He worked for American embassy back then because he speaks 7 languages. Sometimes people say, why don't you go look for your dad? But for me, it's painful.
First name is Matt, last name is Tok. I'm Ari's brother. I was the first generation to be born here. So we carry a lot of weight on our shoulders to honor something that we personally didn't experience, but we hear it all the time. But it's a... So it's in our heads and our hearts at all times. Not as heavy as my mom and dad. I'm happy that Arya's went into art. We need more kids to be fearless and know where they came from, but they also need to know who they are. You know, our DNA goes so far. It's not just from our mom and dad. It comes from our grandparents' grandparents. Somewhere along the way, someone in our family many hundreds of years ago loved art. As much as my sister, you know, she's honoring somebody in our lineage that we've never met before 200, 300 years ago.
Yeah, we're going there together, yes. Well, we'll meet you there.
Before we begin, we would like to bless this celebration with a dance as per our tradition. Please welcome Richita Bovanak, who will be performing the wishing dance.
I'm honored to be here speaking to you all. For those who don't know me, my name is Satara Lim, and I manage an Instagram page called Khmer Renaissance. I'm a second generation Khmer American, CSUOB alumni, and child survivors. You should feel proud of yourselves of the achievement that you have accomplished to break generational curses that you have been born with. I remember the pressure to lift my family out of poverty because they were fresh from a genocide and refugee camps. I remember feeling invisible because my Asian American peers were expected to live up to this model minority myth, while my Khmer peers were focused on surviving gang warfare, poverty, and addiction. The road ahead will be hard, and it will be filled with self-doubt. But I have all the faith in the world that you will find a way to overcome them like you've already done.
Next, we have Christopher Chuk, Master's in Business Administration. Through trials and tribulations, this journey is now complete. I'm grateful to my family and those who guided me along the way for their guidance and unwavering support.
The stories of Cambodian-American graduates at Cal State Long Beach explaining the significance of their education and the legacy of the genocide. This story was reported by higher education reporter Adolfo Guzman-Lopez at the public media outlet LAist. In Hong Kong, June 4th has long been marked by somber vigils, a moment to remember the student-led protests and massacre in Beijing's Tiananmen Square in 1989. This year, though, likely not so much. The government in Hong Kong is closing a vigil site for, quote, maintenance. Also, it's removing books about the event from Hong Kong's library shelves. For more on the situation, we reached out to Tom Grundy in Hong Kong. He's the founder of the Hong Kong Free Press. He spoke with my colleague, Marco Werman.
How are the Tiananmen Square protests and massacre relevant to Hong Kongers today? How do they see that history?
Hi, Marco. Well, it was this big scar, I guess, on Hong Kong's national psyche. It was huge news at the time amid fears of the looming 1997 handover to Britain. And it birthed the democracy movement as we know it in the city, let alone dozens of civil society groups, 60 plus now, have disbanded or disappeared in light of the security law. And arguably, the democracy movement that came out of it ended in all the Molotovs and tear gas of the 2019 protests and unrest that was immediately followed by COVID and the security law, I suppose. But throughout many of those decades, you would often go to Victoria Park in the big Causeway Bay shopping district, and you could hear a pin drop as up to, 100,000 people would gather silently with candles to remember the Tiananmen dead, often singing protest songs, lots of ritualistic funeral marches. And that, of course, has not happened since those protests and the security law kicked in.
So the Chinese central government does a pretty good job at censoring any mention of Tiananmen online. And now in Hong Kong, things are going analog, removal of books about the Tiananmen Square protests and massacre from public libraries. Why now, after several years of this tumult you just described in Hong Kong?
Well, I guess it's a drip-drip effect or death by a thousand cuts. In some sense, it's also extremely fast in what was once, a bastion of press freedom and free expression in Hong Kong. But as this anniversary approaches each year, things get tighter and tighter. And at one point a couple of years ago, people were actually able to break into Victoria Park and gather, and a lot of people did some prison time for that. Last year, there was a bit of a runaround with activists and police around the outskirts of the park. And I remember predicting at that time, and I imagine as June 4th comes around this time, things will be tighter still. I don't know if we'll just see immediate arrests. But of course, even mention of Tiananmen in the mainland is very rare because it is on complete information lockdown and there are a generation of people who know very little about it. It's not quite the case here yet, but certainly with this purge of library books, they are very much seeking to either rewrite history or suppress it in Hong Kong, just as they do in the mainland.
Do we know how many books have been removed?
It's impossible to monitor because this story came about in terms of journalists monitoring certain titles and books. And it was actually a good 2 years ago when we first noticed that dozens had been pulled from library shelves. This latest cull, some reports put it at 250. Others have suggested 40% of political titles have disappeared from library shelves, about 468 volumes. I mean, even romance and travel books penned by activists disliked by the government have gone from the shelves this time as well. But there's no government list of what titles have disappeared. There's no transparency to the process, and there's no way of appealing it either.
Tom, your point is a good one, though. A whole generation was not alive when Tiananmen happened. So what other ways do young Hong Kongers find out about the events of Tiananmen Square?
Well, we can forget libraries. Chief Executive John Lee has said they're not going to host anything that doesn't serve society's interests now. He points to private bookstores, but most of those are owned by the Chinese state, leaving independent bookstores who are never going to stock these titles. Much of them have already been pulled. I guess you can go to Amazon and get them shipped in, and a lot of Hong Kongers will pass these titles around. But for the younger generation, same situation in China, particularly the Tiananmen incident has been wiped from textbooks entirely. Teachers are now doing oaths of allegiance, and there's patriotic education from kindergarten upwards. It has certainly caused a brain drain and an exodus of parents and teachers. But this is taken very seriously by those who remain in the city, because Hong Kong is now a place that you can do jail time for owning stickers or flags or uttering slogans or songs.
Wow. Now, the intended site in Hong Kong for the Tiananmen Square vigil was closed by the Hong Kong government for so-called maintenance. What's that about? What does that mean?
Well, for decades, as I say, you would have a sea of candlelight as people remember the June 4th dead, which is the euphemism we use here. For the Tiananmen crackdown. The park itself, where it happens, has coincidentally, just like last year, been closed for maintenance once again, whilst another section that was often used by vigil goers has been booked by a pro-Beijing group for a shopping event, a group with links to Hong Kong's leadership, and the timing seemingly purely coincidental. I don't know if we will see, like last year, people quietly so-called going shopping, if you will, around the vicinity. And they might have a cat-and-mouse situation again with police. But I think any overt displays of remembering Tiananmen this year will be met with a lot less tolerance, I think, than last year, when even then we saw some arrests.
Tom, I'm wondering if all these actions to suppress the anniversary marking the Tiananmen Square massacre might have the reverse intended result. I mean, one could also see this as the government there is now shining a light on something for a younger generation that the government really wants to hide.
I would say the Hong Kong government is no stranger to the Streisand effect, in that talking about these things and banning stuff left, right and center, the media is definitely more squeezed in terms of press freedom in Hong Kong, but there are a lot of international news bureaus and it doesn't go unnoticed. But this is the long game. This crackdown, I guess, under the national security law is not going to end anytime soon. There is billions of dollars and hundreds, thousands of bureaucrats dedicated to uncovering national security risks. And I would say that since the crackdown, in mainland China at least, there has been huge successes in erasing it from the public memory. It is not talked about. It is certainly not going to be appearing in any textbooks. And it's utterly censored from the internet. In terms of internet censorship, it is still free and open in Hong Kong. But I guess the censorship machine, the national security crackdown, barely knows what it is doing next. Because if you're going to censor it from library books, then private bookshops will be next. And then it will still be accessible online. So one thing happens after the other. And this is a sort of death by a thousand cuts I mentioned earlier. So this is about the long term.
Tom Grundy, in Hong Kong there, we've been speaking about how the government in Hong Kong is trying to stop Tiananmen Square vigils and commemorations in the lead-up to the June 4th anniversary. Tom, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Grundy is the founder of the Hong Kong Free Press, speaking with The World's Marco Werman. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for listening.